Hi, I'm Greg Daniels. I was the showrunner of The Office.
Hello, everyone. It's me. That's right, your trusty host, Brian Baumgartner, and you are listening to The Office Deep Dive. Thank you for joining me once again. Today, I am very pleased to bring you part 2 of 3 of my conversation with Greg Daniels. Now, think of this as the second act of a 3-act play. If Greg's interview were The Lord of the Rings, and it was almost as long as that trilogy, then this would be The Two Towers, which my producer has instructed me to say is definitively the best one. Anyhow, by now, many of you know that Greg was the creator and showrunner of The Office. And what that means is, in addition to doing a bunch of other things, the showrunner is basically the head of the writer's room, which is why I wanted to save this part of Greg's interview until now as the official start of our mini deep dive on the writing of The Office. I'm very excited to kick this series off with Greg, talking about all of his theories on comedy writing, insights into the writer's room itself, and how they came up with so many great storylines. Also, towards the end of this episode, we have a special cameo appearance by Ben Silverman, our executive producer and the guy who initially hired Greg to run the show. It was so fun to have them together in the studio. A little hectic, but fun, and it's always fun and educational to listen to Greg. So, without further ado, let's dive in with Greg Daniels.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
So Mike talked about that you talked about a writing staff and assembling a writing staff, and you described it as being like X-Men, right? That you didn't want writers who could all write the same.
Yeah. I think I called it as a baseball team.
Okay. Okay.
Not that I'm, you know, so much more jockey or anything, but the idea that you can't get all pitchers, you know, somebody has to be really good with story. Somebody has to be really good with jokes. And, you know, I always feel like the story people should be in charge. And they talk about shows jumping the shark. And a lot of times what I think why they jump the shark is because the original writing staff has the more senior people being really good at character and story and the younger people being good at jokes. And then 3 years in, the senior people have left to do their own shows. Right. And the younger people are now the senior people. And it all gets really jokey. But yeah, so I mean, that first staff, the first person I hired for anything on the whole show was BJ. And
you hired him to do both immediately.
Yes, he was a writer performer hire. Yeah. And Mindy also, and I saw her do her stage show Matt and Ben. Mm-hmm. And then I read her script. And I would have met with her off either one of them. And the two of them was a great combo. Paul, I had worked with on King of the Hill. Who else was that first year?
Well, there was Mike.
Oh, and then yeah, obviously Mike.
Yeah.
Mike had a lot of similar background to me. Like he was coming off SNL. Yes. And was intellectual.
Yes.
With a big brain and a similar haircut. So we definitely vibed.
Right. Some of the writers talked about, both from Lee and Mike, this is how they summed it up. So you can respond or disagree that Lee and Gene were, that they were really into, or they excelled at the cringe comedy factor.
Yes.
That Mike was more optimistic.
Yeah.
That Mindy was more absurdist.
And juicy.
And juicy.
Yes. Mindy was very good at finding actual conflict and actual romance between people. She was like absurdist, but also juicy writer. Mm-hmm.
That Paul was very, very into Michael's worst instincts.
Yeah, Paul's really psychological.
Okay.
Very arty and very into psychology and Michael's brain.
And that Jen Salata was very tied into Pam.
That I would disagree with.
Okay. Okay.
I don't, God, I don't feel she was that. I mean, I feel like when I think about Jen, I think about Michael's stories. I think about like the funeral for the bird and stuff like that. And she, another person, super into the psychology of Michael. Jen's fascinating. Jen is like child of JPL physicist people, very brainy. Like all of her work after The Office is like formally interesting. Like she has a screenplay where every scene is from a different year of a guy's life. And she's now doing this animated show about trees. The protagonists are trees. And, you know, she always like sets something really difficult for herself. Like, you're going to do a movie about all the characters are rooted in the same spot. Go.
Right.
But I guess he was doing Pam.
Well, it's interesting that you both referenced the same episode with Michael and the bird. And from your perspective, it was Michael's story. And what Mike talked about was that it was Pam facilitating this for Michael that ultimately made it an important moment. So it's just funny that you
I remember like Jen on the white, I don't know if Mike referenced the whiteboard, but Jen
was
in. No,
what's the whiteboard?
Well, okay, so... So the writer's offices, right, we were in the building that played as their office building. And Michael's office on the second floor was one of the writer's offices. And, you know, we just dressed the one wall that faced the parking lot. And then there was a trailer in the parking lot behind it where we had the table readings. And that was like sometimes a room that the writers would go to when they had to work something out. And that episode was a very... tricky episode because Michael did not know what the story was. Michael was in complete denial that he was really upset that the guy who had his job had died and nobody cared in the office. Like he didn't, but he wasn't aware that that was the story. And he fixated on the bird and nobody knew what the story was until Pam figured it out. But anyway, it's hard to write that. It's unusual because a lot of times we would use these talking heads to announce what the story was. You know, it would be like, today is diversity day.
Right,
and, you know, a guy's coming in to, you know, whatever. And so Jen went into that trailer and we came in and it looked like she was tracking a serial killer. She had like all these lines and, you know, diagrams on the whiteboard. And it was all about in every moment, what does Michael think is happening? What is really happening subconsciously? It was like a very complex story. But that's my like most classic Jen moment to me.
Right. Well, the variety, I've been told that this wasn't intentional. You were looking for the best people. You were looking for specific matches. But one of the things that you did was by hiring people with such diverse backgrounds, even in acting, right? So on the writers, you were looking for writers with different skills. But on the acting side, you know, myself and Rain, essentially, we were straight theater guys.
That's true.
And
that's
I was doing mostly drama. And then you had, you know, Steve and Angela and Oscar, who were like improv guys. And
how did you get so good? That's the part I don't understand. You also used to do something that was so useful. I don't know if I've mentioned this to you before, but we would have these scenes and you need a button.
A button? Yeah. I'm so proud that you said this. Yes. You've never said this to me before, but I thought, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm glad that it was good. Like, obviously it was intentional, but we would get into these scenes and they'd be funny scenes and there was no point to edit. And we were like, how do we get out of the scene? And then we'd be like, Kevin's done something. And we go, yep, there he is.
I'm very proud of that. I'm
Kevin
very
banged into the wall on his way out. That's the end point.
Well, and that, I mean, again, that goes to the ensemble that was being created. I mean, Randall in the beginning, yes. But then certainly as we went on and it was way more Matt Sohn as the camera guy, I would look at him. And I would give him, it was like a quarterback, right?
Yeah.
Who gave a nod to the wide receiver, like the ball's coming your way. Like, go. And at the end of the scene, he would whip that camera around because I had something that I was going to do.
Oh, that's
and
awesome.
To try to find some end. Well, thank you so much for saying that.
Oh, you saved us. You saved us so often. And it's great because you wouldn't know. You know what I mean? Like, I wasn't on set all the time, right? I mean, the 28 episodes, I had to be in the editing room for a ton of time.
And writing new
episodes.
Or
with the writers, yeah. And so a lot of times I would miss some of the fun on set, and then, you know, you'd be in the depths and with me and, you know, Dave in this room in the middle of the night and like, oh, please God, please. Did Brian do anything? And you always saved the day.
Oh
great.
My God. That's so awesome. So how do you feel like Diversity Day helped create our version of the show? And was it important to you at that time that we look at issues of social relevance? Or again, was it just because it was funny?
Oh, well, you know, the first season, a lot of them were great topics. And I remember saying to everybody after we wrapped the pilot, I was like, I had such a great time doing the pilot. And I remember saying to everybody, if this is all we get, I'm happy. We did a great job. And I remember saying that after the first season. I said that pretty much every season for a long time. It was great fun. And in the beginning, it didn't look like we were going to be on for very long.
Right.
So you took what joy you had.
Right.
But definitely when we got 5 episodes for season 1, I know I had the feeling of, well, let's make these 5 count. You know, let's say what we can say with this show in case this is all we get. Let's, you know, do our best. And in adapting it, I felt that all the themes of the show, how Michael would put his foot in it and everything, like when you try and bring that to America, race relations is the big thing that he would do, you know? It's like our history of slavery and race relations and civil rights and everything, it's just more present in American culture, I think. There's a few interesting differences. Like, for instance, in England, for whatever reason, ambition is looked at very poorly. Like how Jim was didn't seem too ambitious. That was a way they were signaling the English audience that he was super likable.
Okay.
But it's different in America. And so, like, I think a lot of times people are more like, well, if he doesn't like his job, why isn't he moved?
Or get his shit together.
Yeah,
right.
You know? And so,
interesting.
Yeah. So that was something that we had to adjust and stuff. But Diversity Day was really big. It was the first time we were like on our own. We're not looking at any British scripts and really wanted to set up the characters properly. And since it seemed like of all topics, and I use this term story,
uh-huh.
I don't know where it comes from. It kind of means like the root story, like the most representative one. And like for me on King of the Hill, it was Hank's unmentionable problem. If you know that one where he's constipated and he has to go in and have a colonoscopy.
Yes.
It seemed like of everything that Hank was, the fact that people were talking about his constipation would be the worst to him.
Absolutely. Right.
you know? And so the Diversity Day was kind of like an attempt to find that super representative story of like, how is Michael going to step in at the worst? And we worked out a lot of interesting things with Diversity Day because the first time that it was broken, it was in chronological order and it took place, I believe, over a couple of days. And then we were like, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right. You know, it feels more docu to be in one day. So we kind of had this flashback aspect to it where we started the story on today's Diversity Day and a guy is coming to train us. And then we found out, oh, they're training because a couple days ago you did this thing.
Right.
We kind of flashed it back. And then with the Pam and Jim of it, I had said to BJ, here's what I want. Something like this, something like he has a terrible day. And they're in this horrible, boring meeting, and she falls asleep, and her head falls on his shoulder, and it's this precious memory for him. And then she wakes up, and it was just this little thing, but it totally turns his day around. I was like, try and find something like that.
Right.
And, you know, and when he came back with the outline, he used that, and he was like, I tried. I couldn't find anything better than that. I thought that was good. you know, and it was sort of like something that people had personal, you know, it just felt very relatable. And that was something I also felt was a feature of Seinfeld, was observational.
Yes.
Stuff like really connecting with people by noticing a moment that everybody's had but hasn't been done to death before. And I felt like that was a good one, like somebody that you liked who kind of leaned on you or something.
Right.
And then we had Tom Huang was our writer's assistant. He was the one who suggested the thing with the cards.
Okay.
Because he had had that happen to him in some training
okay.
thing. And we were like, yep, we'll take that. That's great. It was a really great episode. I mean, I it's hard to imagine. Like, we did 201 episodes, but the second one might have been the best.
Yeah.
You know?
It's, well, it's hard to find many that you could say are better. It's yeah. It's always amazing to me when people, they say one of two things. Like, one, like, oh, I didn't like it in the beginning, but then it caught on. It was too, and then you mentioned diversity, Dan. They're like, oh, yeah, that's, and that was yeah. the second one.
Yeah. I think that, because, I mean, pretty much everything I like or have worked on has had the same sort of trajectory. Like, certainly it was the case with Parks and Rec, but it's character comedy. And if you're going to make the choice to do that Jack Benny thing of your money or your life and not just have a guy stand there and tell the setup and the punchline in the same line, right? If you're going to go with character comedy, you got to learn who the characters are.
Right.
And the audience has to figure it out. And that takes some time. So they always tend to start slow. They don't start with a bang usually. So I wasn't thrown or worried when it started slow.
Right.
But there is a difference between season one and season two.
Well, so that was my next question. So I, you felt like, to my understanding, all of the writers disagreed with you, but after the 40-year-old version and seeing Steve and seeing him in a new way and what his sensibility was, that you needed to change, Michael.
That was a part of it for sure, but... Like, you know how I said the goal with the pilot was, could we even produce something that looked like The Office?
Right.
Right. It was a production type of deal. So then going into season one, it was like, okay, can we write The Office? Can we write stories that are like this and are just as good, but not use the British scripts or anything like that? And then I think we achieved that. But then we didn't have very good ratings.
Right.
And Kevin was really a fan of the show, and the middle management at NBC were fans of the show too, which was really funny because I went to like whatever the upfronts, the things where they yes. would present it, and all the middle management would come and tell me how much they loved it. And they would point to the senior management as being Michael Scotty. Like you could say it was, you know, you could tell like they were feeling oppressed by people, not Kevin, but other people in the structure. But anyway, it was really hard to get picked up. And Kevin said, okay, Greg, you have to come in and pitch me how you're going to change it because it has to change. You can't do the same thing season two as you did season one. And I'm not sure exactly where I was. I feel like I might have been on vacation or something, but I wrote on a napkin. I tried to come up with things that would rehabilitate Michael. And also I realized that I had been treating The Office like everything I'd learned on King of the Hill didn't count. It was a new show and it was like artier or whatever. And then I realized, no, everything I learned on King of the Hill is still valid. And the thing with King of the Hill was when that show started, Hank wasn't very likable. Like I kind of came in and had to rewrite that show a certain amount and create situations where Hank would be able to be kind of conservative, but in a likable way. So a lot of the other characters are there to make him more likable and appropriate.
Right.
You know? And so, for instance, he has his niece there so that he can be very Boy Scouty. And you know what I mean?
Right.
Be like, oh, right.
Yeah.
You know, don't show me your under things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and, you know, his dad is way over the top. Horrible.
Yes.
So that he's kind of, you go, oh, well, poor Hank. I mean, growing
that's
up
where
with
he came
that,
from.
You know,
right,
exactly.
Right, right.
Yeah. He's doing his best.
Right.
You know, so there was like little tricks like that to try and kind of normalize and center the character. Right. And so I come back in with this napkin And it had all these beats that I felt we could create a show around. Like, for instance, the idea that, okay, his team feels very oppressed by him and is always rolling their eyes at him. But if an outsider criticized him, they'd back him up. So that became the Dundies, right? Where everybody's enjoying making fun of Michael's award show. But when people who don't work there start like heckling him and throwing stuff, they kind of rally around him.
Yes.
And one of them was Michael should give somebody really good advice at some point. And so that became Booze Cruise, where he's like handcuffed to something and he tells Jim not to give up ever and to still go after Pam. And I knew people really wanted Jim to do that. So to hear Michael kind of turn Jim and make him stay the course, you really like Michael.
Right.
And there's other examples of it, right? But like, oh, good at his job. And you realize, okay, he's not a great manager, but he's a really good salesperson. You know, he's like everything that makes him a bad manager, his caring what other people think and his changeability and everything and desperate need to be liked makes him a really good salesperson. So it became more like the Peter principle, like he'd been promoted past his level of expertise here, but that wasn't so bad.
Right.
And then, you know, like seeing him with kids, like Halloween, the ending of Halloween.
Yes.
To see him desperately want to have a friend at work, but you can't because you're the boss and you have to fire somebody and just be so bummed out and then just light up when the kids come trick-or-treating and everything.
Right.
Yeah, things like that. And we kind of turned the boat on him. And, you know, that was a different show after that.
Mike told me that there was a lot that basically all the other writers disagreed with you about changing it. The idea being, you were right, by the way, but the idea being like, no, we're doing this special show, and if we burn into a blaze of glory, that's fine, but we're going to keep, you know, that idea.
Yep,
and you and you said, no, we're doing the same show 90%, but we're going to have just a few moments, like you mentioned, at the end of episodes or at certain moments where we just take him and tweak him a little bit.
Yeah, that sounds right. I mean, what I was trying to do was intention, because if you can have a purity of intention, he can do the worst things in the world for comedy. But as an audience, you sense that he didn't do it in order to be cruel or to be a jerk. He's trying. So like the hardest one of all was Scott's Tots. And Lee and Gene are not the guys you go to for this humanizing aspect,
for one thing.
But, and you know, obviously for comedy, right? I mean, and I think Ricky and Steven put it in the bones of the show, right? He does the wrong thing. The show knows what the right thing is, but he doesn't. And he's always doing the wrong thing. And that's like the bones. So it did freak out the writers a little bit because they were worried that it was going to be too far away. But with Scott's Tots, I was like, okay, from his perspective, what he intended was he intended to be successful and to be a hero and to be a philanthropist and to make a big positive impact in these guys' lives. That was his intention. It was a good intention, you know?
Right. It was.
Yeah. It was a good intention. He didn't make it.
Executed
he didn't handle
terribly.
It very well. Yeah.
No, right.
But as long as you, like, to me, that was the key of that episode, because, like, most of it was about the intention. And if you could get that right, you could get all your jokes, but you would still protect the character. And to me, this was a very King of the Hill type of thing, because like in that episode that I mentioned, Hank's Unmentionable Problem, you know, it could have been all butt jokes the whole time, but we played it like a medical drama where the real conflict was Peggy saying, why don't you open up to me? You're going to die. And she's having dreams that his reticence is going to kill him and she's going to be a widow, you know? So we played this sort of realistic drama aspect, and then you got all your poop jokes that you wanted, you know,
but it
didn't look like that was the point.
Right.
So you had a little bit more leeway, and sort of the same thing. I think that, you know, it really hurt Michael that he wasn't able to be the guy he thought he was going to be when he made these promises. So you kind of got all your being a jerk comedy jokes, but you also were like, aw, he's not the worst guy in the world.
Right.
Thank you.
few people have talked to me about one of your core ideas, which is the idea of truth and beauty.
Yeah. That was my thing with Randall. I would go truth and beauty, truth and beauty. Yeah.
And what did that mean to you?
Well, you know, to me, that was, I think that's some romantic poet. I'm not sure where that came from. Okay. Somebody like John Keats or something. I don't know. And I don't even know what he meant by it. But the way I used to use it with Randall was, that's what we're going for in the camera, right? Let the camera seek out truth. That's what it's trying to find. That's the point of a documentary. What's the truth? And also not like a cynical negative truth. Like also where's the beauty? It's like another principle of photography of like a good photograph is, you know, a little sprig of weed coming through the cracked concrete or whatever. You know what I mean? It's like, where are you going to do something that's a little bit inspiring, but find it in a truthful way out in the real world?
Right. Well, Mike Schur talked about it, and you told a story about a parking lot, an endless parking lot with lines and parking spaces. And in one crack, there's a little flower, a little dandelion.
He said that? That's funny. I just made the same.
Yeah.
Yes. I think that, you know, I like the notion of aesthetic, like what are you searching for in art? And the Japanese have interesting aesthetics with a cracked pot. Did he mention that?
No.
I used to use that a lot.
No.
So I think it's called Wu. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But it's the notion of a perfect pot is okay. You know, and we in the West probably value a perfect pot, but a cracked pot where the crack suddenly makes you feel the history of the pot and the people who've used it in their family and have treasured it and kept it even with the crack in it, like it suddenly cracks through, you know, it suddenly will touch you. It's those little details, often of imperfections. That's like it's just a cool sort of philosophy.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have this so far off topic, but a number of years ago, my parents were moving out of their house and I went for a week and I was like helping them and throwing out all of this trash. And we go into like the corner of the closet in a guest room that no one ever slept in. And in the closet, there was a big piece of paper that was folded up and I unfolded it and it was a Kennedy poster that my dad had like handed out or seen or collected or whatever. And I remember saying to him, can I have this? And he's like, yeah, it's like all torn or whatever.
Yeah.
And I took it and I framed it and I took it to the display and they were like, oh, we can, you know, do this or that. And I was like, no, the crack has to stay there.
Yeah.
And the wrinkle, the folded marks, just as lightly as you can mat this on something and enclose it because I want that history of it. I don't know, that idea.
Yeah. Well, also like, I mean, you know, I don't get too psychological, but, you know, when you think about your dad, right, the relationship that you have with your father, the fact how old that they are, and just the sense of, like, passage of time being important to that relationship and fragility of it and knowing that it may not be around forever. And that I can completely see why a tear in your dad's poster adds to the emotion of it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Totally. Well, there's a lot about writing that isn't necessarily only about the office, but, you know, like when you have a set of principles that you're trying to do for the show, right? If you're going to say, all right, I want to be realistic. I want to be relatable. You know, I want to be observational. If you're going to follow those principles, you're going to end up commenting on what's around you. And this to me goes back a long way. It isn't unique to the show necessarily, but like when I was on The Simpsons, which is, this is, you know, it's a complete cartoon, but the way that one Simpsons writer won respect from another Simpsons writer when I was there was you did something super real. You had a line that just found, like it just came out of a teenager and it was just perfectly, you know, real to the situation. And somehow in contrast to the cartooniness of it, that always seemed to be like a cool thing. And then when I got to King of the Hill, we used to do a lot of research. We would go to Texas. I'd take the writers to Texas every season and we'd fan out with our reporters' notebooks and we'd, you know, we'd try and dig up unique stories because I always felt like the shows that I really liked, the stories were original. Like something had happened to one of the writers, or, you know, they weren't just going like, well, what did Cheers do? Let's do a version of that or something. You had to go out and do your own work and dig up your own stories.
Right. Well, Mike Schur told me even multiple years into the run of the show, and at this point we're a huge hit, when we went to Scranton for the writer's convention, they did the same thing. You said, fan out, go walk down this street, see what places you find. And they found restaurants and
yeah, it was cool. We went to Port Richards and
yeah,
a lot of, now of course, like when we done that, when we did the show, the internet was a thing. So you could go online and search all the bars and,
right,
you know,
sure.
Google map or whatever, see what they look like from the outside. But a lot of that happened while we were doing the show. And Phil was great at that. Phil Shea used to go to Scranton and have all these deals with different businesses and radio stations. And he'd come back with props for the set. They were all super authentic.
Right. Well, and on that note, going back a little bit, but why did you pick Scranton in the first place?
Yeah, well, there were a lot of factors that went into that. So you wanted a place that was outside of a city, but they never went, and a place that was a little faded. And I felt the Northeast part was kind of important to me. Like it was an adaptation of an English show, and something about the Northeast, New England, kind of mid-Atlantic felt more like England in certain ways. And Scranton has like a name that's kind of
hard to say.
It's a comedy word. It's got a K sound. It's Scranton, you know. But the interesting thing was that when I picked it, I talked to people at Scranton, journalists, and there's this guy, Josh McAuliffe, worked at the Scranton newspaper, and he was really skeptical that we were going to be nice to Scranton. Right. And I had to say to him, look, you know, I did King of the Hill. I went to Texas. I didn't make fun of them. I understood them. I like did the work to figure out what life was like for people in Texas. And the point is not to do cheap jokes making fun of the environment. The point is to be specific and find a world and you'll be okay. Don't worry.
Right.
So it did work out nicely. Like, I think we got to love Scranton by going to visit for that convention. And then it was, you know, amazing to come back and go to the ball field and everything. And I think it's been good for the city.
Yeah.
And the other thing is like the city is so much more beautiful than, you know, our corner of Van Nuys that we were shooting in next to the granite cutter. I feel like we did a little bit of an injustice to how pretty the city is.
Right.
A lot of natural beauty. Very hard to recreate in Van Nuys.
Yes. Oh, we have a special guest that's coming in.
Hey! How are you?
Hi.
Thank you so much for having fun with us, sir.
Look at you. You're the one that got this.
Isn't this awesome?
Yes. Look at this. Years later.
It's
this
cool.
This is so cool. Yeah.
So I'm going to come back.
All right. Well, you're welcome to
join
in.
Yeah. I'll join you for a minute.
Yeah, Benny, sit down. Pull that microphone in front of you.
Yeah, I'll join you for a minute. I didn't want to interrupt you.
Go ahead. Did you say we're rolling? Okay. Just make sure that mic is close to you. Greg, what were your first impressions of Ben when you met with Ben?
Let me see. Well, you know, Ben, I grew up in New York.
Right.
So Ben has a vibe that I recognized that was fun for me. Like I could sense that he grew up in the same kind of environment of sort of brainy, you know, city life. And that was really fun. And he's got an enthusiasm, like energy that I don't have. Like, we, you know, when you're talking about, you know, the methodical nature,
right?
You could also say maybe plotting of how I approach stuff. And Ben is like, you know, Mercury, like he zooms in, but also very able to draw pieces in from all over the place and make a coherent vision. So I remember finding Ben very cool and attractive. to hang with.
And Greg was always my first choice, so that probably put me in a good position for Greg to view me nice. It's always,
yes, it's always like that.
But and the thing, when you say that about the New York thing, and then we progress to Greg's father now plays bridge with my mother's best friends, you know, 50 years later, yeah. You know, so it's incredible.
Yeah.
Also, the experience that we both had in connecting on this show was like about the architecture of television and the architecture of the idea, because so much about it was newly conceived, but we kept talking about it with a shared love of television. We were people who love TV and we grew up loving TV, you know, and all of those elements drew us. And I think what was incredible about Ricky and Steven in our initial dialogues that we had with them is that they also love TV.
And American TV.
And American TV and American cinema.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing. Like when I grew up in New York on PBS, you'd get Monty Python or Fawlty Towers or something, and you go, oh my God, British TV is so great. You know, it's so smart. And they would only get our best stuff. They would only get like Friends and Seinfeld or whatever. And they grew up with the exact same feeling of like, oh my God, we can never compete. American TV is only the best of the best.
Right.
And when I was expressing at some point to Ricky and Steven how much I was a fan of British TV, they were like, blah, most of it stinks, you know, because they'd seen like all of the failures or whatever that they had been exposed to. And they were big fans of US TV.
And I talked also, Greg, when I was talking to Brian about the intellectual rigor that you have as a person and a writer, not just as a man.
You respond to that. That's the cool part, because most of the time you walk into a situation, people do not want that.
No, they want, and you
scared of that.
And you surrounded the entire show with that. You know, it was an incredible group.
Conan used to in the very beginning of my career, I was writing partners with Conan O'Brien, and he used to say to me, when you overthink, you start to stink.
That's good, yeah.
Because he kind of pegged me as an overthinker. So that would always go through my mind sometimes. But
purposeful. I mean, that's
the thing. Yeah, that's a much nicer. I like the way you're describing it.
Yeah, purposeful. I mean, that's part of
purpose-driven life. Yeah.
Of our conversation was that we were creating something that was against network norms, that was against how traditional sitcoms were constructed. And the reason I say purposeful is because the decisions that you made were made specifically to move that forward.
Well, you also could out-defend anyone who wanted to shift where we were going.
Yeah. I also feel like I was – you caught me at the exact right time, because, I mean, I was trying to add up the number of hours that I had in the – you know how they talk about 10,000 hours? Like I had 10,000 hours before King of the Hill, and I probably had another 20,000 hours, you know, from that show. But I wasn't exhausted. You know, I was like, I definitely had a lot of good experience and a lot of thoughts about how I would do a live action show differently, and still enough energy to try and.
Yeah. And a hunger to do it because it's so different now, but you get kind of placed into a framework really quickly, like, oh, you're great at animation, or I was great at reality, or you're, you know, like, especially when there's only four networks.
It's so different now. It's crazy. But also, like, if you have a particular sense of humor, when I started, there really wasn't any room for that sense of humor in half hour. So, like, I went to Saturday Night Live because late night was where you had to do that kind of more niche, you know, humor. And then cartoons. Okay, well, you can kind of do it in cartoons. Cartoons are single camera form, but you know, they seem to have their own thing. They weren't like your typical network sitcom. And then we had this little crack in the selling world where cable had come out and HBO was big, and the networks were like, well, what should we do? Maybe we should be more like cable.
And I don't think we would have been able without having had a British show to hide behind.
Right.
Right.
You wouldn't have survived. Do you remember the marketing? That was, to me, hilarious, because when the show...
Oh, the way they try to sell it out of The Apprentice.
Yeah. So we had, you know, we'd done the first season, and the marketing department, all they knew was Will and Grace. So they took single lines out of context, pop, 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 right? And that was the first ad. And out of context, none of them played like jokes because of what we were talking about, right? We didn't do like set up punchline jokes. It was all behavior and context and acting and everything. And it was horrifying. You look at these ads and you go, oh my God, we have the stupidest, most unfunny show in the world. And they were like, yeah, God, you guys are going down. And I had to say, look, the frame has to be different. You got to blow up one moment and let it play. Otherwise, we're doomed because it isn't a highlight reel.
Right.
That's not how the show. I mean, now it kind of does. Actually, now everybody loves the show. You could make a great highlight reel out of moments.
Sure.
Well, because they know the characters.
Because they know the characters.
Everybody's so invested in what they're going to do. But when you introduce those characters to a broadcast platform, I mean, it was very tricky.
So they would just like quickly, cut to Michael saying, well, there's going to be downsizing, as if it was a joke. As if it cut to something else.
Greg, what was the decision behind making the incredible casting decision to cast Ben as Isaac?
I probably asked him.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the point that I was sort of making a joke, but that the typical agent Hollywood selling, and that Ben and you are on the outside, sort of an unlikely pair. But I will never forget, we did this panel at the Paley Festival, and we were being idiots, telling jokes and making the audience laugh. And then the moderator addresses a question to Ben, and Ben goes into, at the moment, seemed like 5 to 7 minute speech about the history of comedy and tracing the office's roots. I mean, just incredibly encyclopedia knowledge-like dissertation on comedy in the show. And he stops talking and it's quiet. And you turn to the moderator and you go, well, and that's why he's my boss. And just like that, like there was like, I don't know. It was just, the moment has resonated to me forever.
Yeah. To me, that reminds me of Lorne Michaels. Like Lorne has this ability to put it all together and make a charismatic vision out of it. And part of that, I think, with Ben is the overview, like he's seeing the entire business, the history of the business, all these different genres inside the business, different types of shows, what's next, what's coming down the pike. You know, the overview is what most people don't have. And for him to be able to put it together, you're kind of like, I can't judge if it's real or not, but it's so inspiring. It's like,
well, it has to, future, you have you know? To, it's just so hard to get anyone to take any risk. That if you haven't thought through every element of their organization's thinking about what you're trying to accomplish, you end up running into a wall, you know, and you look to align yourself with collaborators and partners along the journey who are willing to have that fight together. However that works in partnership, because
I don't think I could have done, I mean, it was all I could do to make the show. If I had also had to,
and all they sell wanted to do,
defend it,
and all they wanted to do was not make
it,
the show.
Exactly.
You know, and so that's where you have to be able to do that and put that energy in. But there's so many times I reflect back and I look just how unbelievably wonderful the people were in and around the show itself. Well, I had to like roam the executive suites.
I it was so sad because Ben would come back like covered in blood and gore from being beaten, you know, with all these business types. And he'd come to the set and we were, you know,
making unbelievable work. And I'm like, I wanted to be in this. That was the business I thought I signed up for. But oh my gosh, it was so great to be there. And then all the choices you made that we were able to defend. And I also talked about, and even our physical production apparatus that you created was transformative for broadcast TV. Like they didn't even understand what we were doing in our offices and our writer's room.
Right. Some of those were practical.
Yeah, that they were real and not really, you know, like they were so thrown by it all.
Like we found that we were kicked out of our season one situation. There was not a lot of support in the beginning, and I think for them to
they didn't keep our sets. Yeah, they wouldn't keep it up at the time. I didn't even ever bring that up, but they literally are like, no, we're not going to cover the rent till we make this decision.
Yeah, so we were out, and and we used the parking lot in Hot Girl and stuff, and we'd established what it looked like and everything. So we had to find some place where you could use the street and everything. And we looked all over Van Nuys. And the sad part was most of the places we looked at, I remember.
Were too nice.
Well, no, they were doing porn.
Oh my God, literally.
Do you remember that?
Oh my God, yeah.
I remember going to one place and I was like, well, this looks sort of wholesome. What is this? And it was, there was like a set with a swing and a tree and stuff. And they were like, more porn.
Someone told me this again, in terms of like creating that reality for the actors, that we were going into an office. So there was a little room off of set right behind the accountants where you could watch stuff that was being filmed, where you had an office, but that you built that out to look like an office from the outside. So that the idea was that actors, when they walked onto a soundstage, didn't walk onto a soundstage. They walked into a carpeted area with walls that was like an office. Do you remember that, not wanting the actors to go onto a soundstage?
I remember that on our original set, there was a very low, like low-hanging lintel or whatever. Like the doorway was made of concrete or something and very low. And I would run from my office up to the set to give a note, and I'd run back to watch it, and I'd run back and forth and everything. And I cracked my head on that low thing.
Right.
Do you remember that there was like a pad, somebody put a pad thing up. Like,
yes,
Greg Daniels Memorial forehead pad or something like that. Cause I kept smacking my head on that thing. Yeah. All those smacks knocked out any other memory of why it was there.
All right. Well, thankfully, it seems that the low-hanging lintel did not knock out all of Greg's memories of the show, because we talked about it for like 2 more hours. So I'm going to save the rest for when we dive into the later seasons and ultimately the end of the show. In the meantime, we will be back next week with another interview with one of our amazing writers. Truly, as Paul Feig once said, this was an all-star Hall of Fame writing staff. I'm so happy we got to talk to so many of them. Thank you so much, listeners, for listening, which is what listeners do, and have a great week. The Office Deep Dive is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Tessa Kramer. Our associate producer is Emily Carr. And our assistant editor is Diego Tapia. My main man in the booth is Alec Moore. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend, Creed Bratton. And the episode was mixed by Seth Olansky.